Hello, I'm Kirsty Young, and this is a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For rights reasons, we've had to shorten the music. The programme was originally broadcast in 1980, and the presenter was Roy Plumley.
On our desert island this week is England's senior civil law judge and master of the rolls, the Right Honourable Lord Denning. Now, first, Lord Denning, what are the rolls? Are they the scrolls of the law? Do you have them in your possession?
Well, they're the old parchment rolls which many hundreds of years ago all the records were kept on, of the courts and the government. They were all on parchment and not in books like we have now, but rolled up. And these were the rolls of the realm. And the Master of the Rolls was in charge of them. And we have many now in the public record office, but yes. I was in charge of the rolls of the realm.
And nominally, you're still responsible for the keeping.
Yes, and I'm Master of the Rolls still.
Right. Now, this desert island situation, could you endure loneliness, do you think?
Well, I need either some of your records or anything. I'm not a lonely sort of person. I'd rather have someone with me.
I'm afraid we've got rules about that, but you do have some music as a consolation. Does music mean a lot to you?
Oh, it depends on what kind of music, you know. I'm not at all musical. I like the lighter stuff as a rule.
You have no musical skill yourself?
No, none at all. No, no.
You've never sung in public at a smoking concert?
No, but all my brothers were selected for the choir and the church, but my voice was too bad.
They
wouldn't have me in his choir.
Is there any general reason for your choice of 8 records? Are you choosing nostalgically? Are you looking back?
Oh, yeah, a certain amount looking back, because I've looked back into things which I've hummed and kept in my head or I've known in the past for particular reasons. And that's the reason I've selected what I have.
Well, where do we start? What's the first one?
Well, I'm going to start with perhaps the most English tune that I know of. It's mentioned even in Shakespeare, Greensleeves. And I remember it because when we had a meeting of the speakers of the Commonwealth at Westminster Hall, the Lord Chancellor came in to the tune of Greensleeves, a real English tune.
The Vaughan Williams Fantasia on Greensleeves, the London Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Sir Adrian Boult. Now, Lord Denning, you were born in a small town in Hampshire. I believe your father kept a draper's shop.
Yes.
You went to the local school, first of all?
Well, I went into our own little school, yes, and then I got a little scholarship to the grammar school at Andover, and then we went by train there.
What were your best subjects at school?
Mathematics. I had to get a scholarship like that to Oxford, and English, mathematics and English literature.
Did you have any particular ambition as a schoolboy?
Not particularly, except my mother says when I was a little boy, I said, I think I'm going to become a barrister.
Really?
She remembers me saying that at about the age of 10, but I had no idea what a barrister was.
When you left Andover Grammar School, of course, the First World War was on, you joined the army.
Yes, I went for a little time to Oxford. I was too young. Then I was in the Royal Engineers.
Yes.
Then I had a commission as a second lieutenant. And we were rushed out to France in March 1918, when the Germans had forced us back to the gates of Paris and Amiens, and all us youngsters of 19 were rushed out to hold the line. Mm-hmm. And, of course, my brothers had been there before me, but we were rushed out then, and we held the line. You know Lord Haig's words, there must be no retirement. Every position must be held to the last man, with our backs to the wall and believing in the justice of our cause, we will fight on to the end. That was Lord Haig's message to us, and as you know, we did on, and it went to victory.
How long were you overseas?
About 12 months. I was too young to go before.
And when you were demobilized, you went back to Oxford?
Almost at once. We were demobilized on a Thursday, and I started at Oxford again on the Monday.
And you were reading mathematics, is that right?
Yes.
And you took a first. Yeah. What happened when you came down?
Oh, well, I taught at Winchester, taught mathematics for a year then.
Did you
I didn't want to stay at that all my life.
So, the law instead. Back to Oxford.
Mm.
And how long did it take you to take your law degree?
Oh, well, I got through it quickly at Oxford in, I think, 8 months.
8 months to take a first in law from scratch in 8 months. That must be rather unusual, Lord
Deputy. It is unusual.
What's your second record?
Well, I think we might recall that first war, in this sense, when we were going up to the front line, the band used to lead all of those, us, were going up in our packs and our rifles and everything like that, and used to play down, marching to the station yard, the March Colonel Bogey. Then we got to the station gates. We went all in on our way up in the train station line. The band went back. But we had Colonel Bogey as the last march in our ears before we leapt up for the line.
Colonel Bogey, played by the Royal Marines, the Naval Home Command, Portsmouth. What was your very first brief? Do you remember?
I think it was for 2 guineas in the West London County Court.
Yes.
And then I'd have the little briefs for dock briefs at Winchester, my own town, at Sessions, £1, 3 and 6.
You would sit in court and wait to be briefed?
Wait and be briefed for dock brief. The accused would pick us out. There was no legal aid in those days. We might have a day or 2 days for £1, 3 and 6.
And then you were called to the bar in, I think, 1923, is that right?
That's right.
Can you tell us about some of the judges before whom you appeared as a young barrister? Do you remember any particular great characters?
Yes, there were great characters who could be rather frightening to a young man. Mr. Justice Swift, I remember, a very robust judge. Lord Justice Scruton. There seemed to be greater, robuster characters in those days than there. We are all too polite nowadays. If we did anything wrong in those, and in the county courts, we could be rebuked most severely and lose your clout.
Oh, dear. What's your third record, please?
Oh, to be a pilgrim.
John Bunyan.
Yes. John Bunyan, he's always been sort of behind the family, if I may put it that way, with his Pilgrim's Progress, with his good language, short, easily understood sentences, and, if I may say so, his imagery, and his leading people in the right way, whether you take Vanity Fair or Slough of Despond and so on, Pilgrim's Progress has been sort of a family book.
Yes, sir.
And at the end, Mr. Valiant for Truth gives this poem, To Be a Pilgrim. People don't often remember it, but it is John Bunyan's poem, but it's now in our hymn books, To Be a Pilgrim.
Be a pilgrim, and your spirit so
He who would valiant be by the Worcester Cathedral Choir. Now, you took silk, Lord Denning, 1938, appointed a judge in 1944. Am I right in saying that you've been a judge longer than anyone in English legal history?
As far as I can discover, yes. I've looked back, but you see, now I've been over 36 years a judge. I started quite young, as English judges go, and I've looked back. I haven't found anyone who's been a judge in England longer than I.
And you, of course, have a freehold.
Ah, yes. The newer judges, appointed since 1959, have to go at 75. I was appointed so many years ago, I can go on indefinitely.
Now, you were promoted to Lord Justice of Appeal and then Lord of Appeal in Ordinary, and you remained in the House of Lords until 1962, when you elected to retire and become Master of the Rolls.
I don't know about retire. I went back because it's not nearly so much fun in the House of Lords. It'd be one of five and dissenting. Nobody takes any notice of a dissenting judgment there. So in 1962, I went back. The Lord Chancellor invited me to be Master of the Rolls.
Now, the Master of the Rolls runs the Court of Appeal, and the judgments of the Court of Appeal can be overturned by the Lord. So surely, in a way, you were being demoted by...
Yes, if you call it like that. But mark you, I'm in charge of the show, and we have many, many more cases in the Court of Appeal than the House of Lords, which are not appealed at all. And in that way, we can influence and do influence the day-to-day working of the law far more than the House of Lords.
Yes.
They may reverse us, but that doesn't worry us.
Yes, you have had a number of your judgments rebuffed by the Lords in recent months.
Well, maybe, but that doesn't mean they're right, you know.
In the Court of Appeal, how many judges are there altogether?
Well, there are about 18 altogether, but remember, we sit in courts of three only.
Yes.
And a judge of first instance sits alone. He may have a jury with him, but he sits alone. In the Court of Appeal, 18 of us, each in courts of three members.
And in the Lords, it's five.
Five. There are 9 or 10 of them. They sit as five.
Now, you, as head of the Court of Appeal, you allocate the cases.
Well, I have some say in it. In a sense, I like the cases to be dealt with by people who are expert in it. For instance, if it's a commercial case, I like an expert and commercial judge on it. And if it's a case which has particular significance, it's a case which I think I ought to sit on myself as Master of the Rolls. And so I do have some say in the cases as they're allocated between the various divisions.
Now, of course, you talked about the fact that it's in the Court of Appeal that the law gets formulated and the shape of it is changed. You've taken a very considerable part in reforming the law.
Well, yes, some people rather they criticise me on that. But you've got to remember it's the whole court together, and it's my view that we ought to keep the law in accordance with the needs of the times, and I always try to do what I think is just.
Mm-hmm. In which
don't always succeed, you know, because sometimes I dissent. I always tell a little story, you know. When I was a judge of first instance, I say, sitting alone, I could and did do justice. But in the Court of Appeal of three, I say the chances of doing justice are 2-1 against. And that's only my little joke. But on the other hand, the students do sort of know that I try, if I can, to reform or change the law. And one law student, a girl, wrote to the Times once, and they published the letter. And what she said was, "Sir, with respect to the Master of the Rolls, will his lordship kindly refrain from changing any more laws before the law examinations in August?" You see, that's how the rumour and things go round, but that is the sort of talk that goes round.
Which particular areas have you affected, you think?
See, I don't do the criminal law. No. The Lord Chief Justice deals with that. As you mentioned earlier, I deal with the civil law. And like the whole range, for instance, commercial law, I'm most interested. And we had a great deal to do with husbands and wives. And we had, well, from the very beginning, you know, at one time, wives were very unequal. They were kept right down. They
yes.
weren't given a share of the home or everything. And we did manage to develop quite a lot and give protection for the deserted wife. And nowadays, much more equality. We've got equality of women all the way through the law now.
Yes. Wives owe you a great deal, Lord Denning.
Well, some people say that I've had letters from one man who said, you're a disgrace, he said, to all mankind. To let these women break up homes, he said, I only hope you have the same trouble as us. He said, so take a rose and run right off Beachy Head and don't come back. That's the sort of letters I get from time to time. That was the husband who was disappointed with the decisions of the Court of Appeal.
You get some nice ones from the wives.
Ah, yes. Well, not in that, but in a way I was comforted just recently when the House of Lords reversed us about the trade union matter.
Yes.
I was very comforted about all sorts of ordinary people up and down the land wrote and said they supported us in the Court of Appeal. And that was a great comfort to me when the House of Lords were reversing us.
Record number four, please.
Well, I remember we took all the children to see The King and I. Mm-hmm. When it was first produced at Drury Lane, Valerie Hobson was performing in it, and I remember how the children liked it and how we liked it, and she did it so awfully well. I think it was the first time she'd done much in the way of singing.
Whenever I feel afraid, I hold my head erect and whistle a happy tune so no one will suspect I'm afraid. While shivering in my shoes, I strike a careless pose and whistle a happy tune, and no one ever knows I'm afraid.
Valerie Hobson singing I Whistle a Happy Tune from The King and I. Now, there can be few men in the country with so many honours and distinctions. The number of honorary fellowships in various universities is quite immense. It's a very impressive list.
Well, perhaps I oughtn't to put them in the one university. But they're always awfully good of them. In a way, I always like to keep in touch with the universities, and it pleases me if they do invite me to go.
You're a bencher in three inns of court, or is it four?
Three. I think that's almost a record.
I must.
Lincoln's Inn I started with, my sort of home inn. Then Middle Temple, where I used to lunch all the time, and Gray's Inn. I happen to be a bencher of all three.
A story about you which I admire very much. You are, I believe, the only judge ever to have reversed one of your own judgments. You reassembled the court and announced that your previous judgment should be considered interim. That is unique, is it not?
Perhaps so, but I don't mind if I'm wrong. I don't mind saying I'm wrong and starting again. I've got to get the others with me, of course, all the time, but everyone goes wrong. I'm wrong from time to time, and if it's wrong, well, I'll reverse. Well, I did that particularly. I used to be the only judge for pensions appeals from the war, and there was no appeal from me. But once I was wrong, so next time I'll put it right.
Record number five.
Yes.
What's it to be?
Well, should we go back again to one when I was young and really just about that time of that first war, and we repeated it later on my 80th birthday. The Bar Theatrical had a special collection of matters I was interested in, and we picked The Roses of Picardy. And I recalled then, and I spoke to them of the war in those days and some of the songs which appealed to us most when we were out there in France.
And the record of Roses of Picardy, which you've chosen, is by Webster Booth.
Roses are shining in Picardy, in the hush of the silver dew. Roses are flowing in Picardy, but there's never a rose like you. And the roses will die with the
Webster Booth with Fred Hartley's quintet. At various times you've published technical law books. Recently you've published a couple of books which are more personal and which have a more general appeal.
Well, when I wrote them, I was thinking more of the students of law would be interested in them, and I thought it might help them. But to my great pleasure, and not only the students of law, but lots of quite ordinary good folk read them and have been very encouraging about it.
Yes.
And so I've been very pleased. I've tried to make things simple, principles of law and ordinary living, but simple for the ordinary folk. I always try and do that in my words, and that's what I've tried to do first in the one book, The Discipline of Law, the next, The Due Process of Law.
And you found yourself with a couple of bestsellers on your hands.
Well, they're good enough to say so, and that was very encouraging. I'm glad that people should be interested in them.
The Discipline of Law was published on your 80th birthday.
Yes.
And the new one, The Due Process of Law, that's just out.
Yes, that's right. One a year, if we can find time for it.
You have another one on the stocks, I believe, a family
history.
Well,
no, I should like to, because I refer to, in the others, to the family story. Because we are, if I may say so, I hope, deservedly proud. You see, we were five brothers and one sister. Two of the brothers, one in the army and one in the navy, were lost in the First War. And the other two, there's the general now. The Admiral died a little while ago, but he did very well in the war. And then there's me. And then my sister, well, she's getting on. She's 89.
When do you find time to write? I mean, you sit in court 5 days a week. You have all your reading to do at night.
Well, this is almost a holiday task. You've got to remember, I've got my library at home in the country. I've got a lovely garden to be by. And in the holidays, I did think it was worthwhile, while I'm still going on, to be able to do something of this kind, and that's what I've done.
Mm-hmm.
I've no time in the ordinary term time. I've only got to do it in times like that.
In the vacation. Record number 6 we've got to.
Now, I said just a little while ago how my naval brother had died. Well, at his service, we had this old Methodist hymn, which goes Baron to John Brown's body lies a-mouldering in the grave. It became the battle hymn of the Republic. In these words, mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. It was sung at Churchill's funeral. I was there in St. Paul's, as it was, at Lord Mountbatten's, and at my own naval brother's. And it always recalls me, in a way, it almost exemplifies their character. And that old hymn tune has really stuck in my mind. It's worth hearing.
Mine eyes have seen the glory of the coming of the Lord. He is trampling out the vintage where the grapes of wrath are stored. He hath loosed the fateful lightning of his terrible swift sword. His truth is marching on.
Battle Hymn of the Republic, My Eyes Have Seen the Glory of the Coming of the Lord, by the Robert Shaw Chorale and the RCA Victor Symphony Orchestra. Now, you still live in that same small Hampshire town in which you were born.
Yes.
And the River Test flows at the bottom of your garden, I believe. Are you a fisherman?
No, but my friends are. I like to see my friends enjoy themselves, but also, it's very nice to have the river running through the garden. I've done it all my life, you see. The bright crystal waters of the chalk streams, the trout and the fish there, in our garden with the little bridges. It really, if I may say so, it's the most desirable home one could have.
And I believe you built the little bridges of stones from Lincoln's Inn.
Yes, we crossed the bridges to the other side. The poplar trees which I grow, we brought the old stones down from Lincoln's Inn and we've made our own bridge across the river.
Well, obviously, you are a handyman. I'm disappointed that you don't fish. I'm thinking how you're going to manage on this desert island, because you've really got to get your own food and cook it and make some kind of shelter. But if you can build a bridge, you can do most things.
But I don't know. The bridges are much good on a desert island. You know what? I wonder whether I can get a cup of tea on a desert island. Can you get a cup of tea, or can you get any fresh milk?
Fresh milk is difficult. Now, I know you were thinking of tea as your luxury. Now, that we can provide, because we can easily give you some solar power that'll heat the kettle, and we can give you some tea, so you can have plenty of tea, but I don't think we can manage fresh milk.
Well, I tell you what, there's another little thing. Is quite a little time ago, someone asked my wife, what I ate and what I had. And, she says, we like any ordinary roast beef or lemon sauce and rice pudding. She just put it like that. And then a headline came out in the paper, "He adores rice pudding." Well, now, and a little while after that, I went to luncheon at the Savoy Hotel with some businessmen there and everything like that. And lo and behold, they provided rice pudding for lunch at the Savoy Hotel. Now, please, will you have any rice pudding on this desert island?
I don't think... We can't manage the milk, you see, because your luxury must be inanimate. We can't have any cows there, and fresh milk won't keep long under the sun.
Well, we'll stick to tea without milk.
Tea without milk, I'm afraid.
With your special solar energy and the like.
That's right. Now we've got to your seventh record. What's that going to be?
Well, now, I think on this desert island, I'd like a little light relief. And from Gilbert and Sullivan, if you please, I would always like the caricature of the good judge, and a good judge, too, in trial by jury, after the breach of promise action. And, of course, the elderly, ugly daughter. She'd passed for 43 in the dusk with the light behind her. That's always... And it recalls the career of an old brother like my own at the sessions in Ancient Bailey appearing, and then he becomes a judge. Now I'm ready to try this breach of promise of marriage. Well, that's for me. And I've heard the old Savoy Opera, the Dolly Cart doing it, Leo Sheffield and the like.
Leo Sheffield.
So, please, I'd like to have that, too, on the desert island.
The judge's song from Trial by Jury.
When I, good friends, was called to the bar, I had an appetite fresh and hearty, for I was, as many young barristers are, an impecunious party. I had a swallowtail coat of a beautiful blue, a brief that I bought from a booby. A couple of shirts and a collar or two, and a ring that looked like a ruby. In Westminster Hall I danced a dance like a semi-despondent fury, for I thought that I never should hit on a chance of addressing a British jury. But I soon got tired of third-class journeys and dinners of bread and water. So I fell in love with Richard Turner's elderly, ugly daughter.
I fell in love with Richard Turner's elderly, ugly daughter.
Leo Sheffield is the judge in a 1929 recording of Trial by Jury by the Doyley Cart Company. And now, your last record, what's that to be?
Well, there's one country which we all love, which I love more than anyone, always recalls all the spirit, the love of England, land of hope and glory, mother of the free. That's what I always believed. And in my career, if you will see, for the freedom of the individual. In all my career, I've tried to stand up for the freedom of the individual against the executive power or the power of any great authorities. Land of hope and glory, mother of the free. Pomp and Circumstance is the sort of general title by Sir Edward Elgar.
Land of Hope and Glory, Sir Adrian Bolt conducting the London Philharmonic Orchestra. If you could take only one disc out of your eight, which would you hang on to?
Greensleeves.
Greensleeves. Now, we've heard your luxury, tea and hot water. What sort of tea, by the way? We want to make things right for you.
Well, they often ask that. I prefer Indian tea to China.
That shall be provided. And one book, apart from the Bible and Shakespeare, and please, not a big encyclopedia.
No, well, I think Palgrave's Golden Treasury, I've known it since I was a boy at school. We had to learn it there. And it really is the best, I think, the best selection of English poetry all over the centuries, representative of all. I know many of them by heart. And to recall them, it brings all the qualities of England and words and the choice of words together. I'd like that to be able to dip into from time to time on this desert island.
Right. Palgrave's Golden Treasury. And thank you, Lord Denning, for letting us hear your desert island disc.
But thank you very much for letting me come. It's been most interesting, if I may say so.
Goodbye, everyone.
You've been listening to a podcast from the Desert Island Discs archive. For more podcasts, please visit bbc.co.uk/radio4.